This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Dramatic developments after a day of dramatic developments yesterday in midterm elections. Just a few minutes before 1 o'clock this afternoon, a vital election in Montana was called, with the United States Senate standing at 49 Republicans and 49 Democrats. It was declared that John Tester, the Democratic challenger, has defeated Republican incumbent Conrad Burns. That puts the Democrats at 50 votes. That puts control of the United States Senate in the state of Virginia, where Jim Webb, the Democrat, holds a razor-thin lead over the incumbent George Allen. If Webb wins, that gives Democrats 51 seats and the majority in the United States Senate, as well as the majority in the House of Representatives, which they clearly won yesterday. If Webb wins, it's 50-50. The deciding vote in the U.S. Senate would be cast by the Vice President of the United States. That would be, of course, Dick Cheney, and Republicans would retain overall control. Then, just a few minutes before 1 o'clock Eastern Time, word leaked out from the White House that when he emerged at a news conference in just a few moments after that, President George W. Bush would announce the resignation of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Donald Rumsfeld is both the oldest and the youngest man ever to hold that job. He served first in the Ford administration back in the mid-1970s, then went into business, where he was famously the head of large industrial groups, Bechtel. And then he came back into office at the beginning of the George W. Bush administration, named as Secretary of Defense. He was first the architect of what he called transformation, calling for a lighter, more agile military, where he drew a lot of resistance from many military officers and many of his predecessors as he tried to cut particularly weapons programs that he thought were too expensive and provided weapons that were too big and too cumbersome for the army that he envisioned. After 9/11, Donald Rumsfeld was a principal architect of the war in Afghanistan, a war where he used a unique combination of special forces troops and air power in an effort, and of course Afghan troops as well, to drive the Taliban out of Kabul in record time, an achievement that many hailed at the time, an achievement that has been called into question by policies since then. Of course, afterwards, he was the main architect of the war in Iraq, which was a success at first in ousting Saddam Hussein and his troops, but has been a bloody mess in the years afterwards as an insurgency has grown and developed. 2,800 American troops have been killed in action in Iraq in the 3 years since the invasion of that country. With me here in Studio 3A is Lauren Jenkins, NPR's senior foreign news editor. Lauren, good to have you on the program.
Good to be here, Neil.
And what does the dismissal of Donald Rumsfeld mean for American policy in Iraq?
Well, I think it means a shift. Clearly, the war in Iraq was totally identified with Rumsfeld, and the problems of the war in Iraq were very much Rumsfeld and of his making, and his problems that he had with his own uniformed generals that he felt he knew more about how to run a war than they did. Clearly, his departure means they could, as the president said today, they can have a fresh start. I think they're going to look for options. The current tactics and have not worked, and they're trying to find a way out, still, according to the president, a way out that would still bring them a victory.
Mm-hmm.
What they have in front of them are bad options. It's a matter of finding which is the least bad, probably.
President expecting to meet next week with the heads of a commission headed by former Secretary of State James Baker and Lee Hamilton, a former Democratic member of Congress, of course, was vice chair of the 9/11 commission. They will be presenting him before the end of the year, we're told, with their suggestions for options in Iraq, which some people have suggested might be political cover for a change.
I think so. We've been waiting to hear what that commission comes up with. They've been studying the Iraq war, both here and in Iraq, for months and months. They didn't come out with their report before the election because they didn't want to influence the election in any way, but they expect to come out with something in the next month or so.
Mm. The president also announced that he proposes to nominate Robert Gates, the former CIA director, currently the president of Texas A&M University, to be the next Secretary of Defense. Joining us now on the line is William Webster, former head of both the FBI and the Central Intelligence Agency. Sir, it's good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
And what can you tell us about Robert Gates?
Well, I can tell you that I have a wholehearted admiration for him. He's a longtime friend and colleague and associate. And I worked with him when I was at the FBI, and then he was my deputy when I came to the CIA. And then we continued to work together in the Bush administration when he was assigned as deputy to Brent Scowcroft in the National Security Council. So I know him as a friend. I know him as a man of exceptional character, someone who headed the Eagle Scouts, if you believe that, nationally, as well as an educator. He's bright. He has a lot of qualities that I think will help carry us forward, including the ability to attract consensus, get information. He knows all the players. He knows Jim Baker, he knows Lee Hamilton, he knows the other people who will be passing along their considered advice to him, and he knows how to make these things work. But I don't want to stop there if I can't say a good word about Donald Rumsfeld. I've worked closely with him on a number of issues, particularly the problems of military tribunals, and I have enormous respect for his integrity, his patriotism, the energy that he put into this. And I think history and time will recognize all of those things. But it's a good transition. If he's going to leave, I can't think of anybody better than Bob Gates.
Will Bob Gates be seen as a partisan? Should he be seen as a partisan?
No, I don't think so. As far as I know, he's never been identified in any way with partisan activities. He hasn't shied from controversial issues. But it's been on the basis of intelligence or the other issues that were assigned to his responsibility.
Mm-hmm. You've also been around enough in Washington, D.C. at these moments when changes in the president's cabinet are demanded and asked for. It's an awkward moment for those in power and for those coming in after them.
That's right. But we get through them. And I think that the kind of person Donald Rumsfeld is, he's done what he believed was best for the country and responded to the president in a time when the political realities require some show of change. Bob Gates comes in he's been out running a university, a great university. He comes in with none of the problems of being too closely associated. He's been there before, but this is one in which he comes in without any context on the issues that have been debated in the election.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a good thing.
He was also a member, a contributor to the Baker-Hamilton recommendations, that panel, so he will bring that perspective to this position as well.
Absolutely.
William Webster, thanks very much for your time.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
William Webster, former head of the FBI and the CIA, with us on the phone from here in Washington. Joining us now on the phone from New York City is retired Major General Mike Davidson, who was former assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and was in that position when Donald Rumsfeld took over at the Pentagon. And General Davidson, good to speak with you again.
Well, it's good to be on the show again, Neil. Thank you.
And what can you tell us about the reactions that Secretary Rumsfeld drew from members of the military when he came into office there at the Pentagon? And of course, in the past several months, there have been many retired generals who have called for his resignation, saying that his time was outlived.
Neil, I don't think this is going to be a personal reaction one or another from the guys still serving. But I think they'll be very pleased to have an opportunity to relook some of the strategy, which obviously hasn't worked as well as everybody would have hoped in Iraq. So this is a new day, and I think it'll be very well received. And Gates is very well regarded among military officers.
Secretary Rumsfeld, well, we heard Robert Gates described as a consensus builder. That was not Donald Rumsfeld's reputation.
Not the Donald Rumsfeld that I got to work with. He's a very direct leader, a very strong leader. Unfortunately, he made some of the same mistakes that McNamara made in Vietnam. He wanted to get a grip on the Pentagon, which is almost always a good idea, but then when you get into a war, you need some policy dissent from your senior generals who will go into the Secretary of Defense or the White House and say it's not a good idea. And unfortunately, if you're micromanaging, you don't encourage that kind of dissent.
micromanaging. There's been this spate of books that have come out in the past few months describing the development of the strategies going into Iraq and how they seem to be inflexible and dictated by the Office of the Secretary.
Yeah, you don't want your war planners to be political appointees in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and that's obviously what happened on Iraq.
As you look ahead to Robert Gates coming into the Pentagon, should he be confirmed by the United States Senate, and this would be presumably the lame duck Senate that would be out before we have to worry about who wins in Virginia or not, so the president will have still control of the United States Senate when that happens. But if Robert Gates comes in, what do you think his first priority ought to be, General Davidson?
Well, I think he's going to be a channel, and I think y'all were talking about this a few minutes ago. I think he will be a channel for the Baker Working Group. And you and I talked about this on your show some months ago, Neil. You needed a new set of eyes to come in and look at the strategy. And Gates is the new set of eyes, but he's also that channel back to Lee Hamilton and Baker and the first President Bush, which I think is going to be very important.
Indeed, James Baker, the Secretary of State to the first President Bush, Secretary of State at the time of the first Persian Gulf War back in 1991.
And which has gone down in history as a decisive military victory. Remember, we sent the same army to the same part of the world to fight the same enemy and had a dramatically different result this time. The army hasn't changed, but the way we developed our strategy has.
General Davidson, good of you to be with us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. Good luck.
Mike Davidson, who retired with the rank of Major General from the U.S. Army, former assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, with us from New York on his cell phone. We're bringing you special coverage from NPR News, and this, of course, following the dramatic announcement just about an hour and 15 minutes ago of the resignation of Donald Rumsfeld, rather that the President of the United States had accepted the Secretary of Defense's resignation. We're going to be continuing to talk about how that resignation is going to change U.S. policy in Iraq and indeed politics in Washington, and how yesterday's election results will change policies for the next 2 years. I'm Neil Cohn, and this is special coverage from NPR News. Earlier today, President Bush announced that he has accepted the resignation of Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, who has served in that position since the beginning of his administration. Of course, Donald Rumsfeld served in that position for Gerald Ford back in the 1970s as well, holds the unique status of being both the youngest and the oldest man ever to hold that job. Donald Rumsfeld was the architect of American victory in Afghanistan and also the architect of the invasion and subsequent policy in Iraq. As that policy seemed to have come unraveled in the last few years, he encountered increasing resistance from within and without the United States military. Joining us now is retired Lieutenant General John Riggs. He was one of a half a dozen or more generals who called on the Secretary to step down earlier this year. He's with us on the phone from Palm Bay in Florida. General Riggs, good of you to be with us today.
Thank you, Neil. Good to be here.
And do you think this is past time for Donald Rumsfeld to resign?
Yes, I think it's definitely it's an opportunity.
What did he do wrong?
I think that it really comes down to two areas. One dealt with the approach to the global war on terrorism, specifically Iraq, and the way that that war was fought in not really establishing the necessary troop strengths early on to gain security, so then they could be stability in the process.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the second area really deals with a much broader area, and that's the area of transforming the military for the future. I really think that the record will reflect that that transformation is really not focused on a reality to resourcing strategy. It's really been predicated upon a strategy which is focused on a Cold War approach to the future. And I just think that bringing in a new Secretary of Defense, even at this, supposedly late date, is an opportunity to correct both of those shortcomings.
Going back to your first point in troop levels in Iraq after the toppling of Saddam Hussein in Baghdad, it was General Shinseki who famously said that you might need 300,000, 350,000 American troops in Iraq after the invasion to secure the country. And as we've learned subsequently, it seems that he was purged for making those comments in public.
Well, I think there's some truth to that. I happen to be working specifically for General Shinseki during that time frame. And General Shinseki indicated, and he knew from his past experience in Bosnia, whenever he was in Europe and other places, that it was going to actually take more than likely more troops to provide the phase four, which was the stability phase of the operation, than it would really take to win the war. And that's what he was actually commenting on. And, you know, I mean, we take no solace in being right. Being right is not the issue. And, you know, I honestly, Neil, think it would be a big mistake if we spent the next 2 years dwelling on what went wrong as opposed to spending the next 2 years focusing on what we need to make it right.
And I'll get to that in just a moment. But on your second point, transformation of the military, do you think Donald Rumsfeld's ideas were misguided, misapplied? What was wrong with that?
I think he came in with an idea that that the information age would bring in a new dimension of information awareness, you know, the spreading of information and intelligence, which would have a better informed force. And I basically agree with that. I think also we needed to lighten the force and make the force more deployable and more relevant to the conditions that we would be facing. And I basically agree with that. Where I think we missed the boat is that we've quite honestly continued to fund numerous Cold War type weapon systems. You can read that if you want to, you know, large fighter airplane programs.
The F-22 Raptor is what you're saying.
Specifically an F-22, perhaps even the Joint Strike Fighter, although I think lesser so. And I think also some of the heavy shipping. I think some of that really, it's more politically focused than it is a strategy or a reality focused. And in the meantime, you had the land forces, read that, the Army and the Marines carrying the heavy load, and funding for them for new things and additional troops and the deployment cost associated with maintaining the war. Those were kind of passed over to Congress to fund in the form of supplementals.
Hmm.
I would say that if you had to pick a transformation theme for Secretary Rumsfeld, it would probably be shock and awe. And quite honestly, shock and awe does not work today and is not working in the wars that we're fighting in the global war on terrorism.
And finally, General Riggs, the opportunity now for a new Secretary of Defense to come in on the assumption that Robert Gates, the former head of the CIA, now the president of Texas A&M University, is confirmed by the Senate. What should his priorities be, do you think?
Well, I think the first thing that he should really look at is the global war on terrorism, the war in Iraq, and get an honest assessment from his military commanders, an open dialogue, if that's possible, with his military commanders on what is actually needed to be successful. If he would just open those pipes up, I think he'd quite honestly get the right opinions, and it would give him the opportunity to do the right job.
General Riggs, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Good luck.
Retired Lieutenant John Riggs of the United States Army, among the half dozen or so retired generals who called earlier this year for the resignation of Donald Rumsfeld. And as we were referencing earlier today, he has resigned, or rather that President Bush has accepted his resignation. Joining us now is NPR intelligence correspondent Mary Louise Kelly, who's with us from Pakistan. Mary Louise, it's good to have you on the program no matter where you are.
Nice to be with you, Neil, no matter.
And tell us a little bit about Robert Gates, who is nominated to replace Donald Rumsfeld at the Pentagon.
Well, he's, you know, perhaps best known as being the former head of the CIA. He ran the CIA in the early 90s, from 91 to 93. But he certainly knows his way around Washington circles outside the agency. He has served on the National Security Council. He was Brent Scowcroft's deputy there during the first Bush presidency, and he is highly respected in intelligence circles and also widely known as being a loyal servant of the Bush family. As I say, he served under the first President Bush. He is currently president of Texas A&M University, and he moved to that job after serving as the dean of the George Bush School of Government and Public Service there back, I believe it was in 99 to around 2001. One other point worth mentioning, this is not the first time that the current President Bush has tried to bring Gates into his administration. Bob Gates was actually the first choice for the new position of National Intelligence Director when that job was created last year. And Gates turned it down. And at the time, you know, he didn't go into a lot of detail about why, but in interviews I did with him, he made pretty clear that he thought the job was a bad idea and would add another layer of bureaucracy. So it's interesting to see that he's now apparently changed his mind, going to come back to Washington and going to serve this president.
And, of course, as head of the Defense Department, if he's confirmed, he will be dealing with that new intelligence chief. Of course, the majority of the funding and the majority of the efforts in American intelligence come from the Department of Defense.
Absolutely right. So he'll have insight into that both sides. He'll also, of course, you know, be grappling first and foremost with Iraq. And it's worth mentioning that while Gates has been out of Washington, down in Texas, as we say, these past few years, he has kept his hand in. He is a member of the Iraq Study Group, which is this bipartisan commission that President Bush has appointed. It's being run by another former Bush pair insider, former Secretary of State James Baker. There are a number of heavy hitters on that panel, and Bob Gates has been among them. So he's been very involved right up to, you know, just this current moment in terms of looking at what the issue is in Iraq and trying to figure out how could it be done better.
You describe him as a Bush family loyalist, but he served six different presidents. He came into the CIA at an entry-level job, worked his way up to the job of director. Will he be seen as a partisan?
You know, I don't think so. And that's just my impression from having interviewed him, having talked to him. You know, as you say, he's served six presidents. He's served in a bunch of different administrations. And just to speak to him, he does not come across as someone who, you know, is going to toe a hard Republican Party line. I just don't think so. You know, his CIA tenure was memorable on a couple of counts, one of which was, you know, in his confirmation hearings for that post back in 91, there was a lot of controversy about what role Bob Gates may have played in the Iran-Contra controversy. But those questions appear to be answered. I would be surprised if they came up, you know, in any way that would threaten this current nomination this time around.
And we've mentioned his expertise, obviously, in the intelligence field, and that, of course, will serve him in good stead in this job as Secretary of Defense, should he be confirmed. He'll also need to be a bit of a diplomat, and you're there in Pakistan, one of the key countries in the war on terrorism, and Robert Gates is going to have to be able to understand the subtleties of working with people like President and General Pervez Musharraf, the head of that government there.
Absolutely, and the enormous balancing act that President Musharraf here is widely believed to be trying to pull off, you know, between trying to fight the war on terror and being the U.S. ally and cracking down on extremist elements here, and yet realizing that if he cracks down too hard, he risks toppling his government. I think Bob Gates is well aware of that. I mean, he's run the CIA, getting out of the CIA for most of his career. He certainly has experience dealing with allies such as Pakistan, you know, across the Middle East. He's going to come at this from a different angle. He does not have tremendous military experience, although I was just checking, and he did spend a couple of years in the Air Force back, this was Vietnam era, so a little ways back, but he certainly, those credentials will now be serving him well.
Intelligence correspondent Mary Louise Kelly with us from Pakistan. We know the evening is wearing on there. We appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Neil. Take care.
As we mentioned earlier, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld is out at the Pentagon. Robert Gates, currently the head of Texas A&M University, former director of Central Intelligence, has been nominated by President Bush as his replacement. This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. With me here in the studio is NPR political editor Ken Rudin, and joining us now on the line is Ike Skelton, a Democrat from the state of Missouri and presumably the next chair of the Armed Services Committee. And Congressman Skelton, first of all, congratulations on your electoral victory yesterday and your parties.
Well, thank you. It's a thrill to be reelected, of course, but it's also an added thrill to have the Democrats once again in the majority.
And I have to begin by asking you your reaction to the news that President Bush has accepted the resignation of Donald Rumsfeld.
Well, I told my staff I didn't think that Secretary Rumsfeld would stay through the end of President Bush's tenure, but I was somewhat surprised that it happened the day after the election. But I've got to tell you this, with Mr. Gates coming on board, it's a real opportunity for us to begin a new policy direction, both in Iraq on the one hand and war on terrorism on the other. I hope it's not just a different face on the old policy of slugging it out and staying the course.
As you look at this result, the way the American people voted yesterday, and as you, I'm sure, heard the President of the United States say that he thought a lot of people were voting on their disappointment with the results of the policy in Iraq yesterday, how do you think Iraq policy is going to change as a result of Robert Gates, who you mentioned, the former head of the CIA, now president of Texas A&M University, who the President will nominate as the new Secretary of Defense?
Well, it has to change. Keeping the same course doesn't seem to be putting more electricity into the homes of Iraqis. It's not making it any safer. The oil production is worse than it was when Saddam Hussein was in charge. It's just not a happy place at all, and our young people over there are paying a terrific price for just staying the course. And I think that Mr. Gates has the opportunity to take a good look at it and to change the policies. He comes well recommended. I knew him when he was head of the CIA director. I worked with him somewhat. I was then a member of the Intelligence Committee of the House. And like I say, I just hope it's not just a different face on the old policy.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm hopeful about is that he'll hear us out and listen to us, because several of us have some thoughts. For instance, I recommended to the President a year ago, in October, that we redeploy our troops based upon every three Iraqi brigades that are brought to level one, that is the top level. One American brigade could be redeployed from Iraq. And I received a handwritten note from the President saying that my proposal was too rigid, but I don't think so at all. I think it'd be worked with, and I would hope that the new secretary would hear recommendations such as this.
Mm-hmm.
I also look forward to the Baker-Hamilton study group recommendations and see what they will come up with. That's a very prestigious group, and they're very able.
Well, prior to, we don't know yet what they're going to recommend.
No, we really don't. But the caliber of people on there, I'm sure they will have some ideas and recommendations that we would welcome.
Do you think it is, though, whatever they recommend, time to start bringing American forces home?
Well, I think we should start redeploying troops this year to let the Iraqis know, as well as the American people know, that we're not there in ad infinitum. My proposal of three Iraqi brigades to one American brigade being redeployed, I think still holds well.
There is obviously a struggle now in Baghdad. There is difficulties with an Iraqi government, which includes elements of various militias, including the Mahdi Army and the Badr Brigade, militias that have been allegedly involved in death squads. How do you resolve these questions?
Well, that's up to the Iraqi government. It's up to the Iraqi military. It's up to their police to do so. When a few of us had breakfast with Prime Minister Maliki the day he spoke to Congress, I asked him what concerned him the most, and he said the sectarian violence, and that his goal was to disarm the militias, and hopefully that is still his goal. And how he goes about it, he's going to have to do it. You don't expect the American troops to do it. He's going to have the Iraqi military and the Iraqi police do it. He's going to have that as his highest priority.
Congressman Skelton, thanks very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks so much.
Ike Skelton, a Democrat from Missouri, the ranking member currently on the House Armed Services Committee and soon to be, in January, chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. Joining us now is Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat from Vermont, the ranking member on the Senate Judiciary Committee. And perhaps, Senator Leahy, and first of all, welcome to you, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Well, we know that Ike Skelton is going to be chairman, and I think that's going to be good for the country. He's a superb member of the House and great experience. I won't start polishing a gavel till all the votes are in, but obviously we're watching that one closely. I guess the only state left is Virginia, and the Democrat is comfortably ahead so far.
Let me ask you, though, let's say there's a recount or absentee ballots, whatever. If it's 50-50, would you expect the Republicans to share power with the Democrats?
Well, they'll try not to because they'll say they have the vice president and he can vote to cut ties or to...
Break the tie.
Break a tie, rather. But, and, you know, they're with this administration, I've been here with six administrations, five of the six have really tried to work with both Republicans and Democrats. This one has not. And they're very, very reluctant to work with Democrats. So I think even if they thought they could do it by having the vice president sit in the chair all the time and hold control that way, they'd be tempted to do so.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that'd be a good policy. I don't think that'd be a good policy if the Democrats were in control. But I think that the American people are going to make life a little bit easier by making it 51-49, so we'll know where we are. But no matter who's in charge, there's going to have to be an attempt to find common ground on a lot of areas. I've talked with, before the elections, I talked with a number of senators I've served with over the years, both Republicans and Democrats, especially those who are among the more senior members, they're anxious to see us start working together.
Mm.
Senator Ken Rudin here. There's some indication that Mitch McConnell, who's probably going to be the new either the majority leader or the minority leader, certainly the leader of the Republicans in the 110th Congress, that he's more willing to reach out than Bill Frist was. Given the fact that you'll have new leadership for the Republicans, you have John Warner still there, do you get a sense that there is a possibility of more of a reaching across party lines?
Well, I think so, Ken. I think the thing, Mitch McConnell and I have worked together for years. Some of the times I've been chairman of the Foreign Operations Committee in Appropriations. Sometimes he's been chairman. And we've worked very close together. We've made what used to be a committee that had enormous amount of dissension. We've made it one that works as smoothly as any committee or subcommittee in the Senate. It's because Mitch is a legislator. He knows when you have to cut a deal. I think the problem, Bill Frist, and to defend him, Bill Frist was kind of appointed by the White House to be majority leader. That's a bad mistake to begin with because we're supposed to be independent of the White House. He did not have the experience, and he didn't know how to really make the Senate run. Now, Mitch McConnell will be a tough fighter for his positions. Harry Reid, the Democratic leader, will be for his. But they both know each other well enough, and they know when it's necessary to cut a deal. What I'm hoping we'll do is start having a real checks and balance. I've told President Bush he's not been helped by the fact he's had a rubber stamp Congress. Nobody asked him any questions about anything. Nobody is willing to admit any mistakes. And that's where we ended up. And I'll give you two extremes. During the Clinton years, the Republican-controlled House representatives had 140 hours of sworn testimony and intensive investigations to find out what was on the White House Christmas card list, 140 hours of that. But then when we had Abu Ghraib and all went on there, they had only 12 hours of hearing, and that was sort of a patty cake, let's hide what's going on hearing. So those are the two extremes. One is to totally ignore anything that's going wrong. The other is to be so completely partisan, you're ridiculous. I think that the Democrats can go back to having real oversight real checks and balances, and I think the country would be better for it.
Would you accept, Senator, that if Democrats do take control in the Senate, and you said you're not polishing your gavel yet, but if they do, that the policy on interrogation, on torture, is settled at issue, or would you revisit it?
Oh, no, I would revisit it. The White House has said that if you're being prosecuted and you've been you've been tortured, for some reason you're not even allowed to tell your defense attorney you were tortured. Now, that goes so against everything this country's ever stood for. Of course, that'd be looked at. I think we'd go back to what a lot of the military said when they said don't throw away our checks and balances in our courts of military justice, because those are the things that allow us to hold the high moral ground around the world. I think we'll go back to that. I think that I'd like to see us unrepeal habeas corpus. It was crazy after 200 years of habeas corpus, we threw it out over just a few hours of debate. Those things, of course, we should go back and do, because no matter who is president, Republican or Democratic, removing the rights of people in this country is bound to come back and haunt you.
Senator Leahy, again, thank you for your time today, and we wish you the best.
Thank you. Sorry for the hoarseness of my voice. I think I only got about 2 hours sleep last night. So
I suspect there may have been some cheering involved, too.
What's that?
You may have been run your throat ragged cheering.
Well, there's quite a bit of that in Vermont. We did all right. We only had one Senate seat and one House seat, both open seats, and candidates I backed won them both, and I'm feeling very happy.
Senator Leahy, appreciate your time as always.
Take care.
Pat Leahy of Vermont, the ranking member on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and pending results in the state of Virginia, perhaps the next chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And Ken Rudin, that would put him in a very powerful position to see through any judicial nominees put forward by the Bush administration.
Absolutely, and that's exactly what the Republicans had going for them all these years, and that carte blanche. Even though you could always block nominees in the Senate, we saw that more and more judicial nominees put forward by the Bush administration sailed through, and there'll certainly be more checks on that now.
Mm-hmm. As you look back at yesterday's results, and again, Democrats in the House of Representatives, we don't know the final figure yet. Many seats, a few seats still undecided, but they're picking up about 30 seats. They needed 15. They're picking up about 30. Is this going to be enough of a margin to have a working majority in the House of Representatives?
Well, unlike the Senate, where you basically need 60 votes to get anything done because of the power of the minority, all you need is one vote in the House, really, to take, firstly, to run the committees and to run the show. But what's interesting here is all these new, many of the new Democrats who were elected yesterday are from rural districts, or they're pro-life, they're pro-gun, they're culturally conservative. And it'll be interesting, the Republican Party didn't really mesh together too well on immigration reform, on Social Security, on the war itself, on taxes. So it'll be interesting to see if the Nancy Pelosi's and the Charlie Rangels of the world can get along with the Brad Ellsworth of Indiana, strong law and order, cultural conservative. But I tell you, I think for the Democrats' point of view, it's better to be in the majority and worry about that than be in the minority.
Interestingly, you could have a Republican majority, a Republican party in Congress, not to be confused with the Republican Party, but a big part of it, a Republican party in Congress, which is smaller and more conservative, and a Democratic representation in Congress, which is larger and more conservative.
Well, it'll be very interesting to see what happens to the Republican Party, because today Speaker Dennis Hastert announced that he will not stand for minority leader in the next Congress. There are some rumors that he may not even run altogether. Remember, after the 1998 elections, when the Democrats unexpectedly picked up House seats in the sixth year of the Clinton administration, not only did Newt Gingrich announce that he would not run for Speaker, but then he ultimately resigned his seat. I don't know if Dennis Hastert is planning on resigning his seat. He has said he wouldn't, but he also said he would stand stand for leader, and today announced he will not do that.
And there could be some, as you mentioned, disputes in the Republican leadership in the House. There could be on the Democratic side as well. Steny Hoyer, currently the Democratic whip, would stand to be majority leader. John Murtha of Pennsylvania, the staunch anti-war advocate, we're told, might challenge him.
Oh, yeah, that battle's been brewing for months now. Murtha was told to cool it during the campaign, not make it an issue, but it looks like it's Hoyer versus Murtha, for the majority leadership under Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
And there is also going to be a controversy over whomever Speaker Pelosi, when she gets that gavel, will choose to be the head of the Intelligence Committee.
Well, there's a lot of that controversy as well. Jane Harman would be the logical choice, but Harman and Pelosi don't get along, or at least Pelosi doesn't like Jane Harman. She thinks that Harman has been too soft on the Bush administration. Now, the next ranking Democrat in line would be Alcee Hastings to be chairman of the Intelligence Committee. Hastings, you know, was impeached when he was a judge in Florida. He was impeached by the House, convicted by the Senate, and so the question is whether the Democrats want to put somebody like that in a position of leading the Intelligence Committee.
And if it's neither of them, who might it be?
There are other names I've seen tossed about, but that's one of the major decisions that Nancy, Pelosi, while she's excited and the first, female speaker in history, first Democratic speaker since 1994, but she does have those kind of questions she has to iron out.
And she did say today, as she has said throughout the campaign, impeachment of the president is not on the table.
Right. I mean, there are some mentions of it. There are a lot of certainly some parts of the Democratic left would love to take to bring President Bush into account on what the decisions were to go to war and the truthiness, as everyone said, about the decisions behind it. But she said, no, that's off the table. What I thought was also very remarkable is that no matter what happens in these kind of years, and we've seen it in big Democratic years in the past, 64, 1958, 1982, there's always a Democrat who somehow manages to go down to defeat. Not a single Democratic member of Congress, the House or the Senate, or even a governor, lost yesterday, and I thought that was pretty, pretty remarkable.
And we should, we've been focusing a lot on Congress, of course, and developments here in Washington, D.C. Democrats took half a dozen state houses back from Republicans yesterday, including some very key states, Ohio, New York.
Right. Ohio, New York, Colorado, Massachusetts, the first. This Deval Patrick becomes the second African-American governor ever elected in history. You have Colorado. You have Arkansas.
Maryland.
And Maryland, where Bob Ehrlich was defeated by Martin O'Malley. A pickup of six seats. Now, ultimately, it may not matter to people around the country who's governor of whatever state, but when it comes to redistricting, when it comes to things like the congressional delegation and the lines being drawn, governors can be very, very important. We saw that with Jeb Bush in Florida in 2000. Had there been a Democratic governor in Florida in 2000, who knows who would be president today?
And we have noticed a trend in recent years of governors, some from small states, going on to become president of the United States.
Well, there was this fellow named Clinton from Arkansas, and then we had this fellow named Bush. And actually, before that, the last governor elected president was Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1932 of New York. So it's been a long time since a sitting governor was elected. But, there's a lot of folks who are looking at it. Mitt Romney, who's leaving in Massachusetts. Mike Huckabee, another Republican leaving in Arkansas. Perhaps Tom Vilsack, the departing Democratic governor of Iowa. There are a bunch of Democrats looking at this 2008 field.
And before we get the emails, Jimmy Carter was not the sitting president of Georgia when he was elected.
Or the governor, or the sitting governor either.
Exactly. Ken Rudin, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Neil.
NPR political editor Ken Rudin here with us in Studio 3A. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. You've been listening to Special Coverage. And, of course, stay tuned to NPR News for further developments throughout the day. I'm Neil Conan. This is Special Coverage from NPR News.